Well, an appropriate song for lots of reasons, but also because it's dark. And it's been a while since we've come to an evening service on Sunday when it was dark outside. I heard years ago, of course, about a church, little church building actually in France, where all of the people in that village that needed to have a night service would have to all bring a torch. They didn't have electricity in those days. And if you didn't bring a torch along with you, then there wouldn't be much light. And the more people that came, the brighter the building got. And the fewer that were there, of course, the dimmer it was. And so there are so many applications to be made even of that, aren't there? But we're glad you're here tonight, and has already been the case, to welcome visitors. We're delighted you're here with us. We thank you for joining us for this service this evening. To begin the lesson tonight, I want to introduce you to a couple of different imaginary persons. John, I'll call the first fellow, is a man who has lived a very, very rough kind of life. He's lived hard most of the time that he's been here on earth and has done things that, frankly, would make a lot of us cringe if we had had close association with someone who had been involved in the things he has done. For the better part of four decades in his life, he's lived only for himself. He's been very successful in his field of labor. He has a job. He's been employed. He does all right as far as that is concerned. But he recently has come to realize that money isn't everything and it does not buy you eternal security. But everything has changed for John because he's become a disciple of Jesus Christ. And things are very, very different in his life than they were just a few weeks ago. He's found a joy that he never ever dreamed possible. And given his background, he's just absolutely amazed every day at the grace of Almighty God, about the forgiveness that God has poured out mercifully upon him. He doesn't understand why everybody doesn't come to Christ. In fact, he's just talking to people left and right now that are asking him about his faith. And fact is, he's talking to some people who don't ask him at all. But he's telling them about what he's found in Jesus Christ. And he's so thankful that these changes have come about, of course, in his life. But then in contrast is this fellow by the name of Larry, we'll call him. And Larry is a Christian. In fact, you could probably say that as far as the church is concerned, he's been a lifer. He doesn't remember a time when he wasn't in a church house on Sunday. His mom and dad brought him to church on their knees. They would sit there and, you know, do what most little ones do during services that his family would be attending. Raised in the church, he ended up being baptized into Christ when he was in junior high school, and he just doesn't remember a time in his life where the church was not a part of his existence and where knowing about Jesus was not something that was on his mind. Now, he considers himself to be a rather solid Christian, but lately he's been a little bit bored. And he's been wondering about what he may have missed in life, because for most of his life he's walked the straight and narrow, and there have been a lot of things he hasn't done, and he's wondering about what he may have missed out on by not doing those particular things. And so now he's scooted a little closer to the edge, and he's not doing anything blatant, mind you, but just a little indulgence here and there every once in a while. And sometimes he looks at people he knows that are in the world with a little bit of envy, because they're doing things he's never allowed himself to do. And he wonders about those things often and wonders maybe he needs a break from all those ethics and all those morals and all those restrictions with which he has lived his life. Maybe it's time to sow a few wild oats, because after all, there's always time to repent and to come back. Now, what I have just described to you are two people that are headed in very different directions, aren't they? In the one case of the earlier fellow, he was way out there in the world and decided he needed to leave the world, and so he started making his journey toward God. But on the other hand is a fellow who's known all about God all of his life and is enamored of the world and is thinking about things that he doesn't want to miss, and consequently is being tempted and drawn by those temptations into some worldly patterns of behavior. And they illustrate for us, I think, the question that I'm raising tonight. Are you coming to God or are you going away from God? We're going to be talking this evening about two other men who are not imaginary. They're real. And we read about them in the book of 2 Kings chapter 5. These two characters that are in this text. Their names are not John and Larry. Their names are Naaman and Gehazi. And Naaman is a leper when we meet him who becomes a servant of God. But Gehazi is a servant of God when we meet him who becomes a leper. You ever thought about how these guys kind of met each other in the middle and then passed in terms of what was happening in their lives? One was not a servant of God but was a leper, and he became a servant of God, while one was a servant of God who began to do things that were worldly and wrong. And then he was inflicted, of course, his punishment with leprosy. Their story, I believe, is relevant to every one of us because life is not static, folks. We are moving. And we are moving in one direction or we are moving in another, but moving we are. We're on a trek. We're on a journey and we're going somewhere. And the question really is for all of us, are we growing closer to the Lord or are we becoming more distant from Him? And that's the examination that I want to make tonight based on what we see in 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, open your Bible to 2 Kings 5 because we're going to read a great deal of it and we're going to have to make some observations about these texts along the way. And I can't put it on the screen for you tonight, so I hope you'll take your text and open to 2 Kings chapter 5. Where we begin reading about a man named Naaman, who was a captain of the army of the king of Syria. And he was a great man with his master. He was highly respected because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. Now, I'm reading from the New American Standard. And instead of the word Syria in the New American Standard and in some of the other translations, it uses the word Aram because that is the term that is used frequently about those who live in that area. In fact, just as a side note, you are familiar with the word Aramaic, which describes a certain language that was spoken in that region of the world. Jesus spoke Aramaic. And so that's where this idea comes from, or where that language comes from, or these people who lived in Syria. By the way, Damascus, Syria, is the oldest continually occupied city in the world today. I mean, there have been people living in Damascus, Syria, as far as history records, longer than anywhere else on planet Earth. And so this is an old culture, and it was an old culture even in 2 Kings chapter 5. It had been around a long time. And so here we have Naaman, who is introduced to us here as a man highly respected, a man who was a valiant warrior. But look at the last phrase of verse 1. But, of course, he was a leper. Now, Naaman was a man who had friends in high places. He was obviously close to his master, meaning the king of Syria at this particular time, who, if you're reading in the book of 2 Kings, I believe, you'll read about King Ben-Hadad of Syria. And I guess that if I had to compare Naaman to somebody, I might compare him to General Petraeus. Do you remember General Petraeus, who served our country during the Iraqi War? He was a great hero. He was highly decorated. He was a living legend. I mean, that's the kind of person Naaman was. He is that rank of person as far as military rank is concerned. Syria's borders were more secure because of Naaman. They didn't have to worry about marauding peoples coming into their nation because Naaman kept the borders of that country secure. And his name was a household name. Everybody knew who he was. He wasn't some obscure person down in the ranks somewhere that nobody had really ever heard of except for a few troops. This was a man everybody knew something about. Now, of special note here is that Naaman was not one of God's old covenant people. Please don't forget that as we go forward. He was not a Jew. He was not a Hebrew. He was not an Israelite. He was a Gentile. As far as Israelites were concerned, he was a foreigner. And Syria was at this time one of Israel's dire enemies. And I don't imagine that Naaman would have stayed at home. I suspect Naaman probably led many raids into the nation of Israel. Now, I say all of that about who this guy is because it's not always easy to see God working in the lives of people who do not know Him. But let me tell you tonight that God works in the lives of people who do not know Him. And they may not realize that God, of course, is working in their lives, but God uses sometimes people who are foreigners, people who are not people of the covenant, in order to accomplish His purposes and His will. And God's purpose at this time involved using these marauding bands of Syrians to punish Israel. He was punishing Israel by allowing Aramaeans to come into Israel because Israel had wandered away from God, had drifted away from their covenant, and they were committing idolatry left and right. So picture then Naaman coming back from his military encounters at the head of his men. And here he is leading a long train of captives that they've taken out of the nation of Israel. And he's a military man with all of the accoutrements that are involved with that. I can see a sword by his side, can't you? A gleaming, glinting sword hanging from his side. Medals maybe of some sort pinned to his uniform. If he had boots you could polish, they would be polished. Not sure they had polishable boots in that day and time. But I will tell you, if you looked at a guy like Naaman, he was a man's man. He was a specimen of manhood and power and strength. He has this special rank in the army. He has a special place at the king's side. He has special respect from his countrymen. And he has made some special accomplishments in his service to the nation. He had everything going for him except for one thing. M.D. Anderson did not have its services available to someone with leprosy. You know, I say that because people come from here all over the world. I have never been on an airplane flying back to Houston that somebody wasn't on that plane that was coming here to get some treatment for a disease, the cancer that they're known far and wide for, worldwide, for being able to treat. There was no known cure for leprosy in that day. And as strong and as powerful and as big and as mighty as Naaman was, he had fallen ill to leprosy. It was a severe skin disease. Some acute incurable form of psoriasis. Or maybe it was even some acute incurable form of a skin cancer. The word leprosy was a word that was used for all sorts of skin ailments. I think in Leviticus chapter 14 there are maybe more than a dozen different ailments that are described in that chapter that the priests had to familiarize themselves with. And the word leprosy was used for every one of those particular things. From acne to skin cancers, all called leprosy. And you had to delineate between whether or not some of these things were contagious or whether some of these things were just a nuisance or whether some of these things were deadly. And apparently, Naaman was suffering from the deadly leprosy that would take a person's life eventually. Now, of course, the Syrians, because they're not God's covenant people, they don't respect the law of Moses. So Naaman was still functioning within Syrian society. What would have happened to Naaman had he been an Israelite with leprosy? Well, God had said those people need to be separated from the general population, right? And it would take some time to figure out whether or not this man was contagious with what he had, or whether, as I said a moment ago, it was just some nuisance problem that wasn't going to kill him and it wasn't going to hurt anybody else, but it was just something he was going to have to deal with. But Naaman was not an Israelite. He did not observe the restrictions, of course, of the law of Moses. So it must have been pretty tough for a man like Naaman, who was so successful, to come home every night and taking off all of his uniform and all of the symbols of his power, to see himself undressed and to realize that he had a disease that was eating away his vitality. When he undressed at night, he wasn't the powerful man he looked to be, right? This is the man we meet here in 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, notice going ahead with the story. The Arameans, the Syrians, verse 2, had gone out in bands, and they had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. The name of the little girl isn't given us. She was a Hebrew girl. She was an Israelite. She was a prisoner of war. Somehow she had come to know, of course, working in this household, about Naaman's condition. And in verse 3, she said to her mistress, to Naaman's wife, she said, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, because he would cure him of his leprosy." Now, who is the prophet in Samaria? Since we're not studying 2 Kings, I have to tell you who that was. It's Elisha. And Samaria, of course, is the capital of what we know of as the northern kingdom of Israel. And he's apparently in Samaria at that particular time, or at least that's where he was the last time this girl knew anything about his whereabouts. And she is hoping that these two could meet up, because she has total faith that God's prophet could heal this man of this dread disease. Well, you know, as you continue reading about this in verses 4 and 5, you find that Naaman apparently got word from his wife about what this little girl had said, and he goes in to speak to his master, that is the Syrian king. And he said, "Thus and thus a girl has spoken who is from the land of Israel." And so the king of Syria said, "Well, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, 10 changes of clothes. I read that and I'm trying to think about what the equivalence would be in our day and time. And it depends on how you measure this as to how much your valuation would be about some of this. But just think about what Naaman is thinking right here just now. He's not looking for his Blue Cross Blue Shield card before he goes down to meet this man. What's he looking for? He's looking for all the money he can scrape together. Because he thinks that if you go to somebody that can heal something like this, you're going to have to really pay for that. You're really going to have to be able to come up with some money. And of course, remember, he's a Syrian, and in his world, money talks, right? In other words, you might not even get the treatment that this guy could give you down in Israel unless you came prepared to pay in advance. And so, what he was able to do was to take what I think amounted to about $20,000 of silver and about $60,000 worth of gold, and then 10 different suits of clothing to give to this prophet in Samaria. You know, there's a big problem we have sometimes when we're trying to teach lost people about salvation. Occasionally you run into someone who thinks that this salvation is something that has to be purchased and that they have to buy it and it's going to cost them a great deal in order to obtain it. I'm not just talking about rich people. I'm talking about people that aren't sure about getting involved with a church, because all they've ever heard out of churches is we need more money, and all they've ever done is raise money, and they can surely spend a lot of money, and so to them they're just not sure they can add that to their budget, and so they may be fearful of trying to talk to people that are trying to convert them to the Lord, because there could also be people who think that if they could only have enough money that they could buy some favor with God. If not with their money, maybe with their good works. They don't understand that salvation is a gift. I don't know how many times I've had that incredulous look on somebody's face when I try to describe to them that salvation is free. that salvation is a gift, that it comes by grace, because what else do you get in this world that you didn't have to invest heavily in before you obtained it? Especially something so precious as salvation. Naaman had some things, of course, to learn about God, and he will learn them if his pride does not get in the way. So, what does he do? He orders his servants to load up his best chariot with all this money and all of this clothing, and he gathers a company of elite soldiers, and he heads off down the road for Israel all the way down until they stopped outside the hut where the prophet Elisha lived. I suspect he was shocked when they pulled up to the place where Elisha lived and they said, well, this is the place. This is the place? This is the place where there's this one man in all of this area who could actually heal me of this disease? He was absolutely shocked. God's prophets in that day did not live at the Ritz-Carlton. That is not where they held up. And so look at verse 9, because there it says that Naaman came with his horses, he came with his chariots, he stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. And I want you to put yourself now in Elisha's position. Here is Elisha, and you hear the thundering hoofbeats out in the distance, and you see a plume of dust rising in the desert floor, and through the shimmering heat, you see these horses and you see these men approaching you. And then they all come up outside your house and stop. And Naaman's out front. And having received directions to Elisha's house, he stops, he gets off his horse, he knocks on the door. And he expects what he is used to seeing. I've lost my mind here. Well, Elisha, it was who? Naaman. Naaman expects to see exactly what he's ordinarily going to see with someone so important. Protocol. He's expecting that he's going to see people coming out. He's going to see people bowing the knee due to his high position. But look what happened instead. Verse 10. Elisha didn't even come out of the house. Instead, what verse 10 says is that Elisha sent a messenger. And the messenger just simply said to Naaman, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored to you and you will be clean. How does Naaman react according to verse 11? Well, he's furious. I mean, he's got all these expensive clothes in his chariot. He's got all this money in his chariot. The guy won't even come out and shake his hand. The guy won't even personally present himself there. He sends a messenger out telling him to go dip himself in the Jordan River 7 different times. Let me say to you, if this is not God humbling arrogance, I don't know what is. But it seems to me that must be involved in what's taking place here. The value system of the kingdom of God is very different than the value system of the world, of which we're a part. In the kingdom of God, he who is first shall be last, and he who is last shall be first. And Naaman is furious at all of this informality. He is furious that he's come all the way down here, and the man will not personally greet him, but tells him to go dip in the river. Well, Isaiah, who's a prophet not too distant from this particular time, said of God, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. There are far too many people in our generation who have created God in their minds according to their own image and their own likeness. And by that I mean they have made God into what they like. And Naaman had some preconceived notions about this prophet, and he had some preconceived notions about this God that this prophet represented, and they were not measuring up to his expectations at this particular point in time. But Naaman, like many people today, instead of humbly listening to God when the message didn't match his expectations, he got angry. There was no hick prophet from down here in Samaria that was going to treat him this way. Look at who he is. Look at what he commands. He deserves more respect than this. But then you notice in verse 11 that not only was he furious, he began to say some things. He said, behold, I thought He will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. But he didn't do that. I don't understand that. And then he goes on, verse 12. He said, are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, in other words, Syrian rivers, are they not better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and he went away in a rage. And guess what? He was still just as sick as he was. He was still just as liable to die from this disease as he had been. And then this whole entourage of men and horses and chariots turn around. And they thunder off in a cloud of dust with Naaman raging out in front of them all. I think these verses illustrate for us another of man's tendencies, and that is the tendency to want to alter God's commandments. Wash? Why should I wash? Just have this guy come out here and wave his hand over me. Just have him come out here and call on the name of his God, and surely that will suffice. Surely that will take care of all of the troubles that I have. Let me tell you, he didn't like the idea that he was going to have to go dip 7 times in the Jordan River. And does that not have its parallel in our day and time? With people who will just follow you every step of the way in the teaching you do until you come to this point where you speak of the need to be baptized. And they just don't understand what that has to do with the price of tea in China. They don't understand why that should have any effect whatsoever on their salvation. This just does not make sense to me. And this behold I thought business is exactly why you find a church in existence today to fit nearly every human preference. Because men are trying to make God be and do what they want God to be and do. But these instructions the prophet gave were pretty simple. Go to the Jordan River, dip yourself 7 times there, and you will be healed. Now for Naaman, the story changes at this point because he, like so very few today, was willing to reconsider his position, especially when his servants come near to him and they try to calm him down. You know, when you're in a rage, sometimes you don't think straight. And so they try to calm him down and they said, now my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? And the answer to that question is, well, I'd have done whatever he told me to do. If it was a great thing, I would have done it. They said, well, how much more then should you do what he says when all he has asked you to do is to go out here and wash in the river and be clean? I mean, that's no big deal to do. You'd have done something extremely tedious, but you won't do this very, very small thing. And so after they talk him into this, verse 14 says that he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was cleansed. Naaman was cured of leprosy because he listened to his servants and he listened to the prophet of God and he submitted on God's terms. And if we want anything worthwhile from our God, we have to do the same thing. We have to submit on His terms. We have to do the simplest of things that may sometimes not mean much to us or not seem to be spectacular enough. But that's exactly what people do who are going toward God. They do what God requires of them. Now, I want to turn our attention to the guy in this story whom we have not yet met, but we're about to, who is going away from God. Because he too illustrates a lot of things that are happening in lives of people today. Gehazi is probably the servant that was mentioned back in verse 10, whom Elisha sent out to deal with Naaman. Although it's not said specifically that that's who the servant was in verse 10, that's probably who it was. His name is not mentioned in the next 5 verses after verse 10, but you can be sure that he's there because he sees all of the wealth that Naaman has brought along with him, and he's impressed. He's impressed with a guy that's got that kind of money. He's impressed with that clothing. I'm sure he's impressed with the chariot and the horses and all these soldiers that are along with him. And this will prove to be an overwhelming temptation for Elisha's poor servant, Gehazi. Naaman comes up out of the Jordan that seventh time. His leprosy is gone. He's absolutely elated. I'm sure he was a tad bit shocked. He's overjoyed. Who could find words to express the feelings this man would have looking at his flesh and it looking as it did when he was just a child? So he puts his clothes back on and he races back to the house of Elisha because he's got a lot to be thankful for. And in verse 15, he returns to the man of God with all of his company. He comes and he stands before him and he says, "Behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now." He's not trying to buy anything. This is not what this is about. This isn't a bribe. He's just grateful for what's been done. You know, that's what Christians do when they give, right? They're not giving out of obligation. They're not trying to get something. They're just overjoyed with what God's done for them. And so they are graciously going to give in return. It's the giving of gratitude. But what does Elisha say to this man who wants to give him $20,000 of silver and $60,000 of gold and 10 changes of clothing? He says to him, "No, you just keep your money. I'm not interested at all in your money. As the Lord lives," he said, verse 16, "before whom I stand, I will take nothing." And Naaman urged him to take it, but he refused. He would not take it. We'll skip ahead a few verses due to the shortness of our time. Look at verse 20. In verse 20, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, "Behold, my master has spared this Naaman, the Syrian, by not receiving from his hands what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him, and I will take something from him." Are you following the story there? Elisha says, "No, I don't want your money." Gehazi says, wait, let's not be too hasty here. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. When am I going to meet a man like this in the future? I need something from him. You may not need anything, but you didn't ask me. I need something. So I'm going to run after him. And I'm going to take a gift from him. So verse 21 says that Gehazi pursued Naaman. And when Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from the chariot to meet him. And he said, "Is everything okay?" And he said, "Well, everything is fine. My master has sent me." Uh-oh. We're already in trouble. We don't have to go any further. He's lying, isn't he? Did Elisha send him? No, he didn't send him. But he's telling Naaman, "My master sent me," and he said, boy, he comes up with an elaborate excuse. He says, "We've just now had two young men of the sons of the prophets that have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. So I need a talent of silver and I need two changes of clothes. I'll take that much from you." And Naaman said, "Well, be pleased to take those two talents." And he urged him and he bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of clothes. And he gave them to two of his servants and they carried them before him. So Gehazi has arranged to get something out of this man, you see. And he's done so under false pretenses. Is Gehazi becoming more godly, or has the temptation of all this money made him more worldly? I think we can see the answer to that question, right? When the story began tonight, where was Naaman? Well, Naaman was far away from God, but by the time we get finished with Naaman there, we find out that he has come to the realization that there is not a God in all the earth except the God of Israel. So he's come toward God, hasn't he? But where has Gehazi gone? Far, far into a place he has no experience with. Some place he's not been really before. And then as you get down to verse 25 of the text, he goes back home, Gehazi does, and he goes in and he stands before his master. That's Elisha. Apparently Elisha has missed him. He hasn't been around for a little while. And Elisha said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And he said, "I didn't go anywhere." You know, the trouble with lying is, what do you have to do when you start lying? You either got to have a tremendous memory and just keep it all consistent. Nobody can really do that. Or you just tell more lies on top of lies on top of lies. That's what Gehazi is doing. Is he getting closer to the Lord, or is he being taken further away from the Lord by his behavior here? Well, it's obvious. And it's all because of this temptation that has been put before him. Look at verse 26. Elisha knows better than to think that he's telling him the truth. In fact, here's what he said to him. He said, "Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you?" Put this in our vernacular. Elisha is saying to his servant Gehazi, he said, "My heart went out to you when this guy laid this temptation in front of you, because I knew it was going to be very, very tough for you to be able to avoid it." He said, "My heart broke for it. I understood that this was going to be a big, big deal for you." Is it a time, Gehazi, to receive money? Is it a time to receive clothes and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and male and female servants? And then he goes on to say this, "Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever." You know, I think about what must have happened here, because it says he went out from the presence a leper as white as snow, which means that this happened instantaneously, didn't it? I mean, these words had hardly come from Elisha's mouth until Gehazi could look, and he had this white, flaky skin from head to toe. And not only was he going to suffer with it, but every one of his descendants were going to suffer from it as well. And as he stumbled out the door of that house that day, headed for parts unknown, stripped of his calling, burning with regret, I'm sure, that always comes too late, I wonder if Solomon's words in Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11 might have crossed his mind. In that text, Solomon said this. He said, "Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil." There are so many times in our lives where we barter, do we not? And it's all about time. We know that this is not something I should do, but because if I do it, I'm not going to suffer for it immediately, but it may be something that comes later on, I'm willing to barter that time in order to get what I want right now. And how many people, in conjunction with what we talked about this morning, how many people are there who say to themselves, you know, judgment is a long way off? That preacher was talking to me about judgment this morning, but who knows when that's going to be? I mean, I may never live to see that happen. I may be dead thousands of years before the judgment ever comes. It certainly seems that way, but sometimes God shortens that time. And this passage stands to warn all of us that our judgment may be upon us quicker and sooner than we ever imagined that it would be. We've seen these two men in this passage. They were going in opposite directions. Naaman was moving toward God. Gehazi was moving away from God. The question for all of us is, which way are we moving? Which direction are we going? And if you're moving toward God, wonderful. We encourage you to pursue Him with your whole heart. You're never going to be disappointed by growing closer to the Lord. But if you're moving away from God, then stop right where you are. Don't backslide anymore. You ever heard the old adage that if you're digging a hole, stop digging? Don't make it worse than it already is. You need to consider your ways while there is still time. And though Gehazi's swift judgment seems like the exception, it really isn't. How many people do we know who die suddenly? Or how many people do we know who one day, in a day's time, they have some reversal of some sort that they never anticipated having, and it changed the entire course of their lives? You don't know, I don't know, what our situation will be like even an hour from now. And so it's always best to continue serving God and not be allured by the things that will take us further away from Him. Are you coming? Are you going? That's a real good question, isn't it? And if tonight you need to come closer to the Lord, we're ready to help you do it. We'll be happy to assist you in your obedience while together we stand and while we sing. Hail to